Well, we really appreciated all the music. It is delightful when we can have that in our congregations. I'll say hello to everyone. And there we are. In all of my life, I have never seen such an unusual presidential primary season as I've seen this year. And you know what I'm talking about. It started out with 17 Republicans and at least 5 Democrats. Do you realize a possibility exists that out of those 22 people, that none of them may ever receive a nomination this year? It is very possible. If Hillary Clinton gets indicted, it may go to Joe Biden or somebody else. Many people on the Republican side are pushing for a deadlock in which nobody gets the overall outright majority, in which case there would be a brokered convention. And names such as Mitt Romney or Paul Ryan are being circulated, and so it's not for sure. An unusual strategy going on for this next go-around on Tuesday is that people supporting Marco Rubio are saying in Ohio to their supporters, don't vote for him, vote for Kasich, the governor, so that he will block Donald Trump. And then in Florida, you've got Kasich people saying, well, look, we'll vote for Rubio because we have to block Trump from getting the state of Florida. These are unusual strategies that create chaos in voting circles. There's such a thing as crossover voting. People thinking, well, I'm not really a Republican or Democrat, but I'll vote that way and choose the weakest person, I think, so that in the fall election that my candidate will prevail. And there's a record amount of anger against the establishment, and nobody thought that Bernie Sanders would give such a formidable challenge to the Clinton campaign. And so you have record-setting ratings for the multiple presidential debates, and has there ever been a year where there has been so much debating? It was funny when Donald Trump was asked after the last one, what do you think of these debates? He said, well, haven't we had enough? And then he caught himself, no, if they want to keep going, I guess we can do a couple more. But of course, the church doesn't have a guy. We don't have a particular person in the race, no dog in the race, so to speak. And whether people vote or not, well, that's up to them. But I would like to raise a few questions that I think deserve important answers. Has any of this ever happened before in the history of the country or the history of our ancestors? What does God think about all of this political activity? Can the election process work? Is America capable of choosing the best candidate? Do our opinions matter? What should our political opinion be and why? This morning I'd like to talk about that subject, the overall subject of the political process, the electoral process. In the current political climate of America, where should our allegiance be? I'll repeat that. In the current political climate of America, where should our allegiance be? Historically, when a nation has had solidarity with its people, a dominant leader usually emerges and is very different than having 17 or 20 people that are vying for attention. Generally speaking, a nation is weaker generally when you have so many different people competing. But again, raising the several questions, I want to address first of all, what does God think of all this political activity? What does God think of it? He's seen it not just in our time, but in times past. Because if you consider our ancestry, it doesn't go just back to the founding fathers of this country. It goes all the way back to when the 12 tribes of Israel were first established. It goes back into the early parts of the Old Testament, the history there. When we heard about this already in the sermonette, when Israel left Egypt, it was a theocracy. You had church and state combined. And there was solidarity of leadership. God appointed Moses, and he was a good leader. He was experienced. When he died, it was designated that Joshua would continue to govern the theocracy. When he died, there were the elders of Israel that carried the baton. But then when they died, things became very murky. And as you all remember, according to Judges chapter 21, verse 25, everybody was an authority to them himself or herself. Everybody did that which was right in their own eyes. And so that was a climate we had, and it was a climate of confusion. And that's what happens when there's absolutely no law. There becomes anarchy. Now, I use the example just in auto traffic. If you have an intersection, say 34th Street and Park Avenue, or 75th Avenue is in 34th Street. Okay, that's a huge intersection, one of many. But if you had no traffic lights and no stop signs, can you imagine the chaos that would happen there? People would try to get through and oncoming traffic, and how could you turn left in the congested area with no arrows, no lights, nothing? It was every man for himself. You would have chaos and traffic accidents and a bottleneck. And in a freelance situation, less would be accomplished than if you had regimented laws. Okay, green light, now it's a green arrow, and then it's red, and back and forth. Fewer cars could get through in chaos. And a nation, if it has no laws, would be in a state of chaos. Well, that's what happened with the book of Judges. Everybody did that which was right in their own eyes. So after you had the theocracy, then you had the time of the judges. And for 325 years, it was mass chaos in ancient Israel. And then Samuel, prophet arose, and he became the spiritual leader of the country, and he actually did quite a good job. But let's pick up the account in 1 Samuel chapter 8 and verse 7. 1 Samuel 8. And now we see that Israel is in crisis again. Even though Samuel was a good leader, the nation had gone basically into slavery or into subjection to the Philistines. Joshua was commanded to drive out the Canaanites out of the promised land. But 325 years later, you get to the time where the people that were supposed to be driven out were still regained control and were ready to annihilate the Israelites or at least enslave them for the rest of time. And so that was a catastrophic condition that the nation had fallen into. And God was hoping for a better. He was hoping that the people would follow Samuel and that there could be a theocracy again. The church and state would be together. In 1 Samuel chapter 8, the people had different ideas. And they went to Samuel and they said, look, you know, you've been a good leader. But we want to be like the other nations. We want a tangible leader that we can see, that we could touch, that we can rally around, and hopefully a charismatic man, and somebody that would be our king that we could be proud of. And Samuel was dumbfounded. He says, you don't really know what you're talking about. You don't want a government led by men when you can have a theocracy headed by God. That was what God had wanted and what God gave Israel once they left Egypt. But the people were saying, no, we don't want that. We want a human leader. We want to be like the other nations. And so the thing displeased Samuel. This is in chapters 8 and verse 6 of 1 Samuel. But when they said, give us a king to judge us, Samuel prayed unto the Lord. And the Lord said to Samuel, hearken unto the voice of the people in all that they say to you, for they have not rejected you, but they have rejected me, that I should not reign over them. And that is still true today. It would not be politically correct for leading candidates to say, God is supreme. God needs to direct the affairs of this country. We need to repent and be in harmony with God. That would go over like a lead balloon. And there are different scriptures that indicate that God knew that that would be the condition even today, because things don't change. Human nature is the same yesterday, today, and forever. You find that with human nature, it doesn't want to be told what to do, and it would rather have self-determination apart from God. At this point, God said, the people here in Israel, Samuel, they are rejecting me, not you. Don't take this personally. Verse 8, according to the works which they have done since the day that I brought them out of Egypt, even unto this day, wherewith they have forsaken me and served other gods, so they do also to you. God could also say, you know, I've been through it with this crowd. Well, they fought me tooth and nail coming out of Egypt. They complained. There was lack of faith. No, we don't have enough water. Where are we going to get the food? Well, I'll give you manna. What about going back to Egypt? Oh, we didn't expect to be out in the desert this long. Let's make a captain, and he'll send us back. And they thought that Korah was the man. And Korah knew how to play the crowd. He was a consummate politician. He says, you know, this Moses, he takes too much on himself. I could imagine a debate with Korah and Moses and Aaron and anybody else that might aspire, Miriam, different ones that aspire to be in control of Israel in a debate. And Moses would say, well, I would just try to stay the course. Let God be our director. He's preserved us this far. And Korah would have his moment. I object to what that man's saying. And Moses doesn't know what he's talking about. He's out of date. We need a young leader. We need a fresh face, a chicken in every pot, not manna all the time. We need to go back. And then Moses would say, I think that that's the wrong position. Korah doesn't understand that there is a way that seemeth right unto the man, but it ends in the ways of death. It may seem plausible. In fact, we haven't taken a direct straight line from Egypt toward Canaan, but God is teaching us things. And then Korah, I need 30 seconds to rebut that. That's not right. That's not right. We need to go back. I mean, how much longer are we going to wander in this wilderness? We thought it was going to be over quickly. And we've been wandering around here for years. We're going in a circle. I tell you, the man doesn't know what he's doing. We have credibility gaps here. These are serious issues. In fact, God did test Israel. After they left Egypt, they came to Kadesh. And after 39 years, they came back to Kadesh. Can you imagine for somebody that didn't have any faith in God, that people would say, well, that proves that he doesn't know what he's doing. We've gone in a circle. You know, I used to be young, now I'm old. Am I going to always be in the desert? How do you know this man isn't going to run out? How do we know that we're going to have water in the future? And so forth. We need a king. We need a leader. This is the history of the country. That's what happened long ago, even in a theocracy. So you can imagine how chaotic it was when there was no theocracy with the book of Judges. And then when Samuel is now trying to pull everything together, the people say, no, we don't want God. We don't want him in the picture. We want a king to rule over us. And in chapter 8 and verse, 1 Samuel, chapter 8 and verse 10, Samuel told all the words to the Lord of what was going on. And then under inspiration of God, he explains to the crowd. He says, this is going to be the matter of the king that shall reign over you. And God allowed this to happen to write lessons of history. To write lessons of history. The value of having history is to study it so that we don't repeat the wrong aspects of it. This is why you read when we go through Passover preparation in 1 Corinthians 11, that we are to examine ourselves to see if we're in the faith. And 2 Corinthians 13, verse 5 reiterates it. Examine oneself. And it says in 1 Corinthians 11, I think it's verse 6, and it's repeated later, that the things that I'm talking about here in the Old Testament were written for our examples so that we don't repeat the mistakes. The biggest mistake was leaving God out of the picture. Just like today, people want to get rid of the Ten Commandments. Hey, we don't want them up on the courtroom walls. We don't want to have any reminders of Judeo-Christian deity. You know, we're above that. We're learned. We are advanced people. I'm saying that facetiously. But this type of mentality is alive and well, just as it was even in this time. The people didn't know that they were opposing God, but they did by saying that they didn't want God as their leader. And so the warning was from Samuel, "This will be the manner of the king that shall reign over you. He will take your sons and appoint them for himself, for his chariots, to be his horsemen, and some run before the chariots. He will appoint captains over thousands, captains over fifties, and will set them to ear his ground, to reap his harvest, and to make instruments of war." I mean, we'll suddenly have to have a defense. I mean, God is still God, but not that significant to us. And for a nation that wouldn't trust God, they might as well trust into a military. Well, then they would have to have an army. And Saul, he was saying that a nation that doesn't trust God would start to have to conscript their people to form a fighting force, and it would cost money to do that. Verse 13, "He will take your daughters to be confectionaries, to be cooks, to be bakers, and he will take your fields and your vineyards and your olive yards, even the best of them, and give them to his servants, and take the tenth of your seed and your vineyards and give it to his officers and to his servants to support the bureaucracy. And he will take your men servants and maid servants and goodliest young men and your donkeys and put them to his work, and take a tenth of your sheep, and you shall be his servants. And you shall cry out in that day because of your king that you shall live, that you shall have chosen, and the Lord will not hear you in that day." He was basically saying it's going to be very expensive. There's going to be taxation. He's going to confiscate your property. You're going to wish you never had a king. Verse 19, "Nevertheless, the people refused to obey the voice of Samuel, and they said, 'No, but we will have a king to reign over us, that we can be like the other nations.'" And isn't that the case? It's nice to be liked, obviously. But if you have to compromise with God, it's not worth it. "And that our king may judge us and go out before us and fight our battles." And so Samuel basically said, "Well, have it your way." There is a Mideastern proverb that's interesting. It says, sometimes it is a curse to get what you wish for, unless you wish for something that's appropriate, that's good. There's a way that seemeth right, but it was wrong. It ended up creating misery for the people. In fact, it was so bad, just if you think very quickly, after King Saul and then Solomon, then his son Rehoboam, when he was in charge, he was oppressive. He was a taxer. He wanted more money. He wanted more power, and he listened to bad advice. And he said, "Well, my father, you know, they're complaining that they had were chastised by whips in order to support the army and to build his public works and to give so much extra money to that they felt taxed." And Rehoboam says, "Well, it's going to be different. I'm going to be even tougher. My father chastised him with whips. I'll chastise him with scorpions. That'll make him knuckle under." No, it didn't. The people revolted. It was the first tax revolt of many in this country. And the revolters chased the king out of town. They almost killed him. They did kill his tax collector. If you would have asked them, "Oh, are you sure you want a king?" They might have thought, "Well, maybe it's better. Maybe we can turn back the clock." But at this point, God said, "No, you wanted it. You got it." And through time, even though the transference of power was supposed to be clear, the king died, the son took over, there were different interruptions of that. There were different people that played politics to try to get control of the kingdom, different ones of the palace guard. And if you go past the time, we don't have time for it now, but with King David and King Solomon, there was a palace intrigue, different people, important five-star generals like Joab and Abner that were vying for control, trying to manipulate from the outside. You had one of David's sons, Adonijah, with a very, very clever plot, much more clever than a brokered convention, to be able to get the throne. Almost like Lord of the Rings, my precious ring, my precious control over the... themes just seem to be repetitive, don't they? Over, you know, name the century and there's something going on that's similar to this theme. This power and an effort to aggrandize from the bottom. And then there was the king, king's son, Absalom. He was such a charmer. He was attractive. He had charisma. And he wanted his father's throne. And he wasn't going to get it unless he took matters into his own hands. And he would listen to the people. Well, tell me, where are you from? Oh, are you from Israel? Well, and you're standing in this long line to talk to my father, the king, because of some difficult matter? Oh, if I could only be the one to help you. Because you know what? Your cause is right. I agree with you. And remember, I'm a nice guy. So when somebody would come, stand in the long line, then Absalom would say, well, where are you from? Oh, you're from the outer reaches of the kingdom? Well, you stand in line because those, you know, that person didn't constitute much power, wasn't a potential supporter. Where are you from? Oh, Jerusalem? Oh, and how long have you been here? Two days waiting to hear the king, see the king? Well, I think your cause is good. And by the way, I feel your pain. I feel your pain. That was a slogan that seemed to work for one of the consummate politicians of recent time. Perception is reality. People will fall for that. How do you know if the person feels your pain? Well, he said so, and he seems nice, and he's telegenic. He looks good on TV, and he's and so forth. So what else is there? You know, people have very shallow... a view of this. Well, as I said, what does God think of all this activity? Well, one thing that is lost on society, and it was a shock to me when I first became aware of what the Bible says, I used to think that human nature was inherently good. I didn't understand that if we are left to our human nature, just as ancient Israel was, and human reasoning, why, if we have a king, everything will be great. instead, it says in Jeremiah 10, and this was a shock to me when I first considered it. It doesn't surprise me now. Jeremiah 10, verse 23, O Lord, says Jeremiah, I know that the way of man is not in himself. It is not in man that walks to direct his steps. That's where it's so helpful to have God to trust in, to God to be the leader, to inspire. Whenever decisions are made in the church that are far-reaching, we try. We're imperfect people, but the ministry and the leadership is required to fast. And pray and ask God to be the director of whatever it is. And whether it's to choose a location for yet another site for the Feast of Tabernacles or to make some immediate change or like changing the Good News title of the magazine to Beyond Today that ties into the TV program and is easier, maybe a single identity point. But things like that, or the meeting with the Council of Elders, there's prayer and fasting that precedes that in order to improve the odds of us arriving at the right conclusion and the constant realization that God knows best and that we need to be in subjection to God's leadership and that we can invite God to be a part of the leadership of the church just as we invite God to be steering our lives. And it's the principle carries. One of the most important things we can do is to realize that we're not 100% there without God. And that Jeremiah said, as a result, because I am not perfect, because I don't see everything that I need to see, because I still have things to overcome and to change, he says, guide me, O Lord. And in King James, it says, correct me, but with judgment, not in your anger, lest you bring me to nothing. And measured, you know, a little bit at a time, perhaps. But be merciful to me, but just help me to change. Help me to move in the right direction. When you see the warnings that Samuel had, it's even magnified with what we see today. We have taxation, hidden taxation that surprises people, but it all adds up. We have the income tax, Social Security tax, state income tax in many places, city income tax in places like New York. Then there's the intangible tax, excise tax, I say gasoline tax, and tax on tobacco, that might be all right. And there are up to 60 different taxes. And those many times are hidden, user fees they may be called. The cost of insurance now that's imposed on every man, woman, and child. And so it adds up. And in some countries and areas, it's 80-90%. And it's going up in this country. Life can be expensive. And I listen to the debate, and everybody wants lower taxes, improved infrastructure. We're going to balance the budget. We're going to have better education, less crime, strengthen the borders, more prosperity, affordable health care, free enterprise, redistribution of the wealth, human rights for everybody, a stronger military, make great America great again, save the planet, save the whales, save the unborn infants, save the country. Who's going to pay for all of that? We're $20 billion almost, or trillion in debt, and that's the official debt. And there are other experts that argue, no, there's an additional 50, maybe 75 trillion dollars. We're in astronomical figures that we cannot even imagine. And there is no more time to kick the can down the road. There's all this jingoism and tough talk about we're going to work better deals with other countries. I could see where we could push that. But we are operating out of position of weakness as a country. It says the borrower is servant to the lender. And you don't have much leverage ultimately. And if there is a way that the rest of the world can envision a life without America, it may try to do so, because the Chinese and the Japanese and the Vietnamese and other nationalities do not want to be pushed around by this country. There's been jealousy for many decades, and they have their own, legitimate economies. And so it's not a pretty picture. And this is because of what happened, traced back to 1 Samuel 8, 7. Samuel, they've rejected me, God said. And we still reject God. We do by our actions, and it's a very, very difficult situation that we find ourselves in. If we go over to Deuteronomy 28, the blessing cursing chapters that were given by Moses to ancient Israel, and it applies to us today. And so many of the prophecies have repeated themselves. As often, for example, as it gets down to 32 degrees, water, if it's outside, will freeze. It'll turn to ice. As often as that happens. As often as people obey God, they will be blessed. As often as people shove God out of their lives, then they will accept the consequences. Deuteronomy 28. Let's notice the blessing if people put God first in their lives. And if a nation doesn't, at least individuals can. Says, it shall come to pass, if you shall hearken diligently to the voice of the Lord to observe all his commandments, that which I do this day, then the Lord will set you high above all nations of the earth, and blessings shall come upon your head and overtake you. Verse 3, blessed shall you be in the city, and blessed in the field. Blessed will be the fruit of your body, and the fruit of your ground, and your cattle. The animal flocks will be blessed. And harvest, bumper wheat crops, and other produce in abundance. Verse 6, blessed shall you be when you come in or when you leave. And the Lord will cause your enemies to rise up against you, to be smitten before your face, and they shall come at you one way and run away seven different directions. And the Lord shall command the blessing upon you in the storehouses, and all that you set your hand to do, he shall bless the land. And all the things that the politicians have promised would be provided if God were the number one director and spiritual leader of the nation. God, Moses is saying, this is what can happen if a people will turn to God. And there's so many other prophecies about that that we could turn to, but I'll just quote some of them. Jeremiah 3, Jeremiah 18, church, and Jeremiah 36 are classic ones. Ezekiel 18, where it says, turn back to me, O Israel. He says, God says, I do not have pleasure in the death of the wicked and those that come up short in life because they've disobeyed divine law. So, God pleads with all flesh, Jeremiah 25:31, and we have that opportunity, giving a message in the media. And if you've read the newest magazine, it's pretty strong in places, telling it like it is and explaining that we have problems because people do not put God first, and nations do not put God first, and even some theologians do not know the true God. Unfortunate. When we look at ourselves, we can ask, do we see blessings in this country? Well, there are still, yes, this is a blessed nation. But there are problems. There are cracks in the foundation. We have an infrastructure that's falling apart. Not enough money to put it back together again. We've got Interstate 35 in Minneapolis where the whole interstate almost at rush hour collapsed. One bridge on Interstate 5 collapsed. It was 80 years old. We had a person that attended here that had a job who working on pylons, checking bridges under the water, and saying, you know, I can't pass and certify a bridge to be safe unless it really is. And was explaining that it's really stressful when the people above me, they're on a quota system. Hey, you gotta do five bridges a day or whatever it is. And he says, I've got to be thorough. It's not going to be on my head if the thing collapses. And, you know, we've had buildings and, collapse. And it's shoddy workmanship, people cutting corners, and the need to restructure the infrastructure. So are we blessed? Are we blessed when you look at 9/11 and sleeper cells and people that are plotting to create havoc in Western civilization? In this country, I think we know the answers to these things. We live in troublesome times. We live and consider situations that were unimaginable when we grew up. I went over a few weeks ago to jog on the track at the King High School, which I've done for the last 3 decades. They were shut down. Bomb threat. Everybody had to go home early. And there was another bomb threat. Shut down at one school because somebody brought in a loaded pistol. And these things happen. Random shootings. We did 30 years ago, 20 years ago, we didn't have shootings in San Bernardino. And workplace violence, quote unquote, happening where people had different issues to settle with others. We didn't have Columbine massacres as a rule. But it's different today, and there are many reasons for that that we don't have time to get into. But we are becoming a secular society that doesn't think God has any purpose at all. And Isaiah, well, while we're in Deuteronomy 28, if we were to read the rest of the chapter, we would see that all these blessings would be reversed. And so from verse 13 on, you've got all the curses that happen. And, you know, foreclosures, a dollar that's worth less and less, and different diseases. Even bubonic plague is made a comeback in some areas. MRSA, Maybe it existed years ago, but most people never even heard of it and talked about it. West Nile virus and other such things. Anyway, what does God think of all of this political activity? Not much. Not much when he is kicked out of the equation. And yet people don't see it. When somebody says, we're going to make great America great again, and there are several people running now that are saying that, I don't hear the phrase that you could get out of James 3, verses 14 and 15, God willing, if the Lord will. And it's like we're going to do this on our own, Yankee ingenuity. It may happen for a while if God would allow it. But God is not pleased that America is becoming secular. Senator Rubio said, America is great because each generation before us did what it had to do. Well, you could argue, yes, it brought in immigrants, it fought various wars. But without God in the picture, and maybe he didn't intend it to be taken without God in the picture, but how long can we expect to get the breaks, the blessings, the help? You know, it may be a little bit gaudy and over the top, but when people like Tim Tebow, I can recall, kneels to pray, it says in Matthew 6, suggests that we pray in private, but it would appear that he's been rejected from football, even though he was a first-round draft pick. People, coaches, they don't want to deal with the, quote-unquote, the God thing. And people don't want God in their lives, we see more and more. They feel that they're going to be missing out, that they're going to be made to do something that's not attractive. The society talks about Jeremiah 6. The society that was described in ancient Israel applies today. I'm going to go to Jeremiah 6 and verse 15. Jeremiah 6. Well, let's back it up to verse 11. Verse 10. To whom shall I speak? Jeremiah 6:10. And give warning that they might hear? Behold, their ears is uncircumcised, and that they cannot hearken. Behold, they have no heart, no interest in it, in the way of the Lord. The word of the Lord is unto them a reproach. They don't have any delight in it. Therefore I am full of fury of the Lord. I am weary with holding it in. I will pour it out upon the children abroad and upon the assembly of the young men together. For even the husband and the wife shall be taken, the aged with them full of days. And it talks about a time of punishment in national captivity. And their houses shall be turned unto others with their fields and wives together. For I will stretch out my hand upon the inhabitants of the land. He may do that in a sense through other nations. From the least to even the greatest of them, everyone is given to covetousness. That's a description of so much of society today. And I think that sometimes we don't realize how deep that is. But then, even though it's 25 years ago, an incredible book came out, The Day That America Told the Truth. And people were interviewed. What would you do for $10,000? 3% of the population back then, which is more degenerate now. Back then, 3%, I believe it was, that said, well, they would be willing to murder somebody for $10,000. And then 10% would be willing to slander people. And it was very, very telling. How many people would cheat on their income tax? Back then, it was 25%. And I'm leading up to something in a minute. But it says here in verse 13, from the least to the greatest of them, everyone is given to covetousness. From the prophet, even to the priest, everyone deals falsely. They have healed also the hurt of my daughter, of the people slightly, saying, peace, peace, when there is no peace. Were they ashamed when they had committed abominations? No, they were not at all ashamed, neither could they blush. Neither could they, therefore they shall fall among them that fall, at the time that I visit them. And God only does this because he loves people. He only punishes those whom he loves, and he wants a better life for them. And so he wants to steer them as a loving parent would direct a child. And along with this, and it's easy to read and gloss over this and underestimate it, but Isaiah chapter 1, Isaiah 1, verses 3 through 7, talking about the ox knows its owner and the donkey his master's crib. But Israel, and that would include modern-day Israel, which includes the United States, does not know, my people do not consider, a sinful nation, laden with iniquity, a seed of evildoers, children that are corruptors, that have forsaken the Lord, that have provoked the Holy One of Israel to anger, they are gone away backward. That's not every last person, but way too many. Why would you be stricken anymore? Why will you revolt more and more against God? And he describes here the whole head, which represents the government, is sick and the whole heart is faint. The heart representing more the spirit of the country and people, and even the people at the bottom, the sole of the foot, even to the head, there is no soundness, but wounds and bruises and putrefying sores. They have not been closed, neither bound up, neither mollified with ointment. And it leads to national disasters. People that are hopeful, that want to help, may have the most noble of intention, that aspire to be president. Only God knows the inward heart. But how can God bless a nation that is going in the wrong direction? In verse 10, hear the word of the Lord, you rulers of Sodom. That's pretty acerbic. Give ear to the law of our God, you people of Gomorrah. Pretty indicting. And God is an optimistic God. He's, maybe people will change. And he's pleading with them. He loves these people. Verse 14 says, your new moons, your holy day, holiday, pagan festivals, appointed feasts, I hate. They're a trouble to me. I'm weary to bear them. When you spread forth your hands in the prayer in this mode, I will hide my eyes from you. Yes, when you make your many prayers, I will not hear. Your hands are full of blood. I don't see all the blood that occurs, the behind-the-scenes activity and some of the bribery. But God says it's there, and it's very pervasive. And in verse 23, it says, describing how things get done in this country, your princes, leaders, are rebellious and companions of thieves. Everyone loves gifts and goes after rewards or bribes. And they judge not the fatherless, neither do they judge the cause of the widow that comes to them. I've seen, or read anyway, where the Secret Service would talk about different of our leaders that would go to maybe foster homes. And when the cameras were rolling, oh, they were smiling there. When the camera people were gone, okay, we're out of here. It's a different world than what is presented. So that's why. And I don't have time to go to Isaiah 59, talks about truth. Where is truth? It's fallen in the streets. It's not that God is unable to reach out and to help, but that people don't want that. The statement has sometimes been said, people generally get the leaders they deserve. And immoral people are not going to typically vote for moral people. Honest people are not going to typically vote for dishonest people. And I don't mean to say that every last person is bad. In the world of politics, it would not surprise me if there are some good and honest people. So rather than point the finger at anyone, I'm just saying generally there are problems. And yes, there are people that do have genuine and good intentions, and you hope for the best, but the Bible says that the underpinnings of society are very, very wayward. And people may present an outward veneer, but deep down inside there are issues. People who continually sin typically are not going to vote for the righteous. Darkness does not like the light. Just as bosses hire those whom they feel comfortable with, people vote for those whom they feel comfortable with, especially if those selected give them money, gifts, or permission to do whatever they want to do. Getting back to the mindset of the book of Judges. So can the election process work? That was one of the questions that I raised. Well, theoretically, it's possible. But when you consider the moral fabric of society, what do you think the society is going to choose? People that are dynamic, God-fearing? No, not likely. Not likely. A question I also raised, is America capable of choosing the best candidate? Only if they yield themselves to God. And if they did that, then maybe they would invite God to be the provide a leader themselves. People are blinded by charisma. For all the talk of position papers and debates, endless debates, do you realize that looks matter a whole lot? That people that needed to run for office sometimes consulted with advertisers to learn how to project a smile? Earl Warren, who was the Supreme Court Justice, had an advertising group help him when he became to become governor of California. And they said, you've got to change your smile, and then we think we can get you in. Since 1900, with one exception, the taller candidate won. So who's going to win 2016? It could be that simple, unless it's already locked up. I don't know. But too often people are blinded by charisma. Oh, he looks right. He sounds right. Absalom, back, we didn't turn there in 2 Samuel 14. He was one that was a charmer. He said what the people wanted to hear. And he basically said in his own way, I feel your pain. I think you're right. You need to see my dad. And when he knew that dad wouldn't have time to see everybody, then he says, well, you know, you stick with me. And he built up a power block. And then that power block revolted. And it led to the death of Absalom. But it seemed right to him. There is a way that seemeth right, but it ends up in disaster. Charismatic slogans. No, the Great Society under Lyndon Johnson. Well, what was great about it? The Vietnam War? The assassinations of Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy? That happened during, you know, his tenure. The phrase burn, baby, burn, where cities of main cities in this country were on fire with protesters upset. Those were troublesome times. And anyway, there have been different phrases like that, even up until recently. Richard Nixon claimed, we're going to have law and order. Law and order. And it was embarrassing when his vice president resigned in disgrace for accepting bribes, just like what we saw in Isaiah 123. And then he himself, a year later, resigned in disgrace. And so it's not the property of any one political party. It's just the fabric of society. And it's no different than in the ancient Israel, when people thought, well, we'll just have to stone the messenger, so to speak. We'll reject those people that talk about God too much. So they told Amos, why don't you just go home to your home country? Elijah, aren't you the one that troubles Israel? Why do you tell me, King Ahab? Jeremiah says, Zedekiah, I'm putting you deep down in the well, unless you have any word from the Lord, and that is, you're going down because it's not politically expedient for me to be seen with you. Zechariah was a prophet. They said, let's put him to death. Micaiah. Ahab said, that guy never says anything good. Lock him up. And then Micaiah says, you'll never make it back from that battle at Ramoth-Gilead. And that's been the mindset of people. Well, we've seen, is America capable of choosing the best candidate? It potentially could, but because America is going in an immoral direction, it is very unlikely, because they can't imagine choosing anyone that's much different than themselves. They just can't imagine that. They can't imagine many, or increasingly, there are wonderful exceptions, but many cannot imagine that God should be brought back into the equation. Do our opinions matter? Well, if we can't change the course of things, yes, they do. Now, so we should go out and vote? Well, that's up to you. I have never voted because I never believed it would make a difference. Because God will end up choosing, he allows, that is, the leaders that he will allow. Mentions that in Daniel 4:16. I won't have time to turn there, but even allows some of the basest of men for his own reasons. It's not what he wants, but if he doesn't intervene to prevent that from happening, that oftentimes is the way. And when you look at the history of the world, you look at Joseph Stalin, Mao Zedong, Pol Pot, Idi Amin, and even people in recent time, Mugabe and others, there are a lot of people that have been base, that have been in high power. And in anciently, different world conquerors, Nero and others, same thing. God has allowed this to finally teach man that he cannot manage his affairs without God. There are a few times where pockets of brethren would live, such as in Big Sandy, Texas, where they dominated even the local area. And because of that, they did elect the local mayor. And the purpose was in order to control the environment so that they would have be able to operate in peace. What God says, though, in 1 Timothy 2, in verse 1, 2 Timothy 2. Where is it, 1 Timothy? Yes, 1 Timothy 2, verse 1. I exhort, therefore, first of all, supplications, prayer, intercessions, giving of thanks be made for all men. And that means, verse 2, for kings and for all that are in authority, that we may lead a quiet and peaceable life in all godliness and honesty. I personally don't have a great deal of hope that this country will be improving its circumstances. Maybe for there might be a little spike of improvement, but it's all going in the wrong direction overall. But I do understand emphasize here the need that we at least pray that we have free course to preach the gospel, that as long as possible we can have freedom of religion, freedom of assembly, some of the blessings that the Constitution allows for, and that we can meet in peace. We do not have any... We're not going to raise a vendetta against any political party or any candidate. I ask the question, do our opinions matter? You might say, well, if you're not trying to change the system, then how could they matter? Well, it matters to us. It reminds us to think, am I part of this world or not? Am I part of its ways? Do I believe that mankind has the inherent ability to solve it all by himself away from God? Or do I believe in God? And if you believe in God in that way, you're going to say that your allegiance is to a higher power and it's to a different kingdom. This is what Christ was talking about in John 18 when he was brought before Pilate and he was facing a crucifixion. And Pilate thought that, well, he has a chance to talk his way out of it. Why, he seems to make sense. And I don't really want to put him to death and to cow down to a rabid crowd like is outside my door. And so in John chapter 18, in verse 29, then Pilate went out and said, what accusation do you bring against this man? And they answered and said, if he were not a malefactor, we would not have delivered him to you. Then Pilate said, take him and judge him according to your law. And the Jews therefore said, no, it is not lawful for us to put any man to death. Oh, they wanted to, all right. That the saying of Jesus might be fulfilled that he spoke, signifying what death he would die. Then Pilate entered into the judgment hall again and called Jesus. And he said, are you the king of the Jews? And Jesus answered, saying, say you this of yourself, or did others tell it of you to you? And then he gets frustrated. He says, am I a Jew? Your own nation, your priests have delivered you to me. What have you done? Jesus, you know, when people are guilty, a lot of times they'll do a big song and dance and go through elaborate defense. You know, I really am not responsible for this. It wasn't me, and so forth. But when people are to the point, they tend to be honest. And Pilate sensed that with Jesus. He says, what have you done? And Christ answered, quote, my kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, then I would do something. My servants would fight, and I should not be delivered to the Jews. But now my kingdom is not from hence. And Pilate wasn't expecting that. And our kingdom is not this world. We are privileged to live here. We have some freedoms here that our spiritual ancestors never had in centuries gone by. And how long they will last, I don't know. But our opinions matter to us. If we understand where we are in the spectrum of prophecy, we know that the next kingdom, the millennium, the kingdom of God is right around the corner. That's where our allegiance should be. And I think of Hebrews chapter 11. It'll be my last scripture here. Hebrews chapter 11. Interesting concept of being pilgrims and strangers on this earth. This applied initially to Abraham, but it has an application for us today. In Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 8. By faith, Abraham, when he was called to go out into a place which he should after receive for an inheritance, obeyed, and he went out, not knowing where he would go. Because he lived in an area, he was 75 years of age when God called him, and he was a prominent individual. He was a statesman, actually, in the region of Babylon. He was considered a philosopher, a theologian, a teacher, a professor, an astronomer, and had an international reputation. He was set for life. He was wealthy, and he was told to leave it all and to go follow God. And it happened in a way where he knew really and truly that it was God and not just some crazy whim. So he didn't know what God had in mind. In verse 9, by faith he sojourned to the land of promise as in a strange country, dwelling in a tabernacle with Isaac and Jacob, the heirs with him of the same promise. For he looked for a city which has foundation, whose builder and maker is God. Through faith also Sarah herself received strength to conceive Isaac, and was delivered of a child, and she was past the age because she judged him faithful who had promised. Therefore sprang there even one, and him as good as dead, so many as the stars of the sky in the multitude, and the sand which is by the seashore innumerable. Just millions and millions of descendants promised to Abraham. These all died in the faith, not having received the promises, and having seen them afar off, and were persuaded of them, and embraced them, and confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims on this earth. We are strangers and pilgrims on this earth, in a sense. Yes, we live here, we have homes, but our allegiance is not to this society, per se. It is the kingdom of God that comes. That's permanent. That will be here for eternity. The new Jerusalem that comes down from heaven, in Revelation 21 says that, that will be where the saints of God will initially dwell once the city comes. And this was a city, in a sense, that Abraham and his descendants were looking for. And we pursued the same thing when we celebrate the Feast of Tabernacles. One of the valuable lessons is that we are sojourning. We are in temporary dwellings because we are strangers on this earth. We're aligned to God, and the closer we are to God, the less attractive it is for us to be aligned to the political affairs of man. We are identified in 2 Corinthians 5 and verse 20 as ambassadors for Christ. And ambassadors, if they're in other countries, their allegiance is not to the other countries. They get along. They're inoffensive. They collect information, but they never forget who they represent. And we cannot forget our allegiance. So, in conclusion, I raise several questions that I think we can see the answers to that are appropriately raised. Has the political scene that we see before has ever happened before? Yes, in other election years in the history of this country, but you can go back to ancient Israel, where there was jockeying of position, and I didn't have the time to go through all the palace intrigue and the political winds of in 2 Samuel and the Book of Kings and Chronicles. That would take a series of sermons. But certainly we have precedent where other people vied for the leadership of the country in the past. So, yes, mankind has seen this before. And what does God think about this activity? If he's not in the center of it, it always goes downhill. Can the election process work? Theoretically, but very unlikely, because people will choose those that reflect their values instead of God's values. Do our opinions matter? We cannot lose, we cannot underestimate the importance of what we think. If we understand that we are first and foremost aligned with the kingdom of God, that's where our attention should be. And trust God to work it out in these elections, that we will have free course, that we can do the work of God, that we can complete the work of God. And when I see how strong some of the statements are, here, right here is a I'm just quoting page 25 of the recent edition. Right here is a warning to our religious audience who think that the religious base of the nation will rise up to restore the moral underpinnings of the nation. They can't. The religious leaders themselves, not everybody, but too many are blind, leading the blind, have forsaken the law of God and the way of God at its core. How long will society tolerate difference of opinion? Human nature doesn't want to be told it's wrong. We'd rather be told what we see in Isaiah 30 and verse 10. Don't tell us the truth. Speak unto us smooth sayings and prophesy deceits. Isaiah 30 and verse 12. Condition of human nature has not changed. The good news is that if all these things are prophesied, that they would happen when God would allow it to, the rest is going to happen. Christ will come back. He will establish his government on the earth. We will have an opportunity to be a part of it, to be administrators. Revelation 2:26, Revelation 3:21, Revelation 5:10, there are promises throughout the Bible talking about this, a coming government, and the blessing of that in Ezekiel 36, bumper crops, wonderful agriculture, reforestation, renovation of cities, building the infrastructure. It's promised there. People coming, flowing by the millions to Jerusalem. They'll say in Micah 4 and Isaiah 2, you know, he has hurt us. He will bind us up. Hosea 5, another one. That it will turn around. Then millions will come and say, let us go to the house of the Lord. He will help us. He will guide us. His laws, his ways, his representatives. And we'll be busy. That is very tangible. It's important for us to refamiliarize ourselves with these things so that we're not at all persuaded that the here and now is where it's all got to happen. We'll do the best that we can. We'll pray for the best outcome possible, or that our leaders will at least give us the freedom that we've had in the past to do what we need to finish. So with that in mind, I think we have a better understanding of the political process that is flawed and, as some people say, broken, and that in spite of that, life will continue to go on. And maybe God will give a reprieve. One last thing, he might give us a King Josiah. If you understand, at the end of the demise of Judah, with wicked King Manasseh followed by wicked King Ammon, that out of that, there was one last spiritual hurrah where God rose aloud a very young child to become the next king, Josiah. And he was a good king. And he slowed down the degeneration of the country, actually made some important spiritual reversals for a short time. once he died, and one of his contemporaries, Jeremiah, was sick to heart to know that he was gone, and that represented the last human hope of the country. We could have a Josiah, but ultimately what we need is Jesus Christ. Our kingdom is not of this world. It's of the future world. Let's be thankful that there is rhyme and reason to the overall plan of God, and that we don't just have to hope that the right guy wins and that somehow mankind can work it all out by himself.